This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The White House budget called A New Foundation for American Greatness was released last week, outlining the administration's wish list. It includes major tax cuts, major cuts to safety net programs, a dramatic increase in defense spending, and a predicted 3% growth that would balance the budget in a decade. White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney called it a proposal that puts taxpayers first. Sarah Ferris has looked at the numbers, and she joins us on Radio Times. She covers budgets and appropriations for Politico Pro. And Sarah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Since White House budgets rarely, if ever, become law, why does this budget matter?
So this is really the first glimpse of policy that we are actually seeing from the Trump administration, besides just a couple of bullet points on some campaign documents. This is really the first major messaging document, and it's had a big impact so far in how Republicans are seeing what they should expect from the Trump administration. This is going to be really the opening salvo of 4 years of Trump trying to accomplish his policies.
It does include tax cuts. Who's the major beneficiary for these tax cuts, would you say?
Well, it doesn't have too many details on the tax cuts, as the Trump administration has laid out, this would benefit wealthier families and corporations more. But there's actually not too many details in the budget document itself. It just accounts for what it says will be a major tax plan that passes sometime over the next decade.
There are cuts to safety net programs. Do we know more about? Do we have more detail on that?
Yes. So this is one of the takeaways that Republicans have been pouncing on the most as well. Republican lawmakers don't want to see more than $1 trillion in cuts to social programs, particularly farm aid. That's something that that you don't hear a lot from Republicans on Capitol Hill talking about. They want to make these subsidies to farmers any less generous. But we're also seeing the proposed cuts to food stamps, the proposed cuts across the board, Social Security, disability insurance. These are programs that are popular from both parties. And even in past Republican budgets, you don't see as deep of gutting of these programs.
Let's say I made $50,000. I had a couple of kids. Would I like this budget, Sarah?
Probably not. This is a budget that is really more for either defense hawks or fiscal hawks. So if you are in support of boosting military funding, if you are in support of really decimating funding to almost any other domestic program, those are the two groups that are really that have cheered this budget. There are some conservative groups in Washington that are saying this is a more prudent approach to governing up here in Washington. There are also some defense groups that say that have praised the amount of money that is going towards defense. It would be the biggest spending boost to the military since President Ronald Reagan's budget. But everything in between, if there's people who like their Head Start programs, if there's people who like Meals and Wheels, these are, again, pretty popular on both sides of the aisle. And the Trump administration takes the axe of them pretty hard.
Do the numbers add up? There's been some question about accounting, if not irregularities, at least playing a little fast and loose with the numbers.
That's something that you see in pretty much any presidential budget, as well as the budgets out from Congress each year. There's always some sort of either optimistic economic growth. The Trump administration lays out a 3% economic growth over the next decade, something that most economists would say they do not predict will come true. We've been seeing about 1.9%. That's what the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office is projecting. I think the most recent estimate for last month was 1.2%. So assuming 3% is very high, but this is something that Donald Trump thinks will happen as a result of the tax cuts, as a result of these massive spending cuts. So that's one really big area. And then in terms of the tax cuts, they have also said that the Trump administration has said that these tax cuts will be revenue neutral, meaning they won't add money to the deficit, but they're also counting that revenue as helping to drive the economic growth. So there's a claim about double counting, although the budget director, Mick Mulvaney, disputes that.
Is this a form of trickle-down economics?
That's definitely something that the White House has said that they're working to achieve. They are taking the cue from Ronald Reagan in a lot of ways. Even President Reagan had proposed cutting some of his farm aid. He was really proposing the same sort of across-the-board cuts, but the Trump budget does go even deeper into a lot of these programs. They're saying that by reducing the role of the federal government almost entirely in some areas, like the cuts to the State Department are about at one-third. So the Trump administration is arguing that if those cuts do materialize over 10 years, the federal government will be less in people's lives, and the anti-regulation push that they're doing, they're saying that will lead to more economic growth.
Is there any way to know how a Trump supporter, and of course they covered the gamut, but how a Trump supporter would be affected by this budget, assuming some pieces of it make it through Congress?
Well, it is difficult to characterize. As you said, there's a lot of the supporters do run the gamut, but in a lot of ways, these domestic programs that a lot of people rely on, particularly in rural areas, which, as we know, was a large part of Trump's base. It's not just the farm cuts that I've mentioned, but also Medicaid is the low income healthcare program is something that a lot of people rely on in rural as well as urban areas who are low income, and so that he's proposed more than $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid over 10 years. And there's a whole plethora of programs that really benefit people in who are lower income, and a lot of those would not see the light of day in 5-10 years. The funding for that is pretty decimated.
And of course, that tosses some of the responsibility to the states. And assuming how flush the states are, I guess some can do better with Medicaid than others. But clearly, they're going to be losers under that formula.
Right. And the argument from a lot of public health advocates is that if you give states a certain amount of money and you tell them to use it on Medicaid, that doesn't necessarily mean they will. There's been instances in the past where that kind of block granting with certain programs actually means that states are backfilling other budget holes. So there's a lot of instances in this budget where the White House wants to delegate responsibilities to the states, wants to set aside money for that, or to not set aside any money and just tell states they need to figure it out, like with food stamps. But there's some big concerns about where the money will go, how states would use it. Of course, as we said, this is a completely messaging document. This is not something that's going to become law.
Let me quote something from White House Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. He said, there's a certain philosophy wrapped up in the budget, and it is this. We are no longer going to measure compassion by the number of programs or the number of people on those programs. And then he talked about basically the necessity, the value, the dignity of work. Thinking about those safety net programs, how many people getting those benefits are either working but working poor, or disabled, or elderly? Do we know, Sarah?
Well, there is the comments from Mr. Mulvaney, which he echoed all of last week, really were a defining characteristic of this budget. He says it's the plan to replace the welfare system, as you said, with dependency, with dignity of work, which is really interesting thing that we heard from the Trump administration. And yeah, there's about 44 million people who benefit from food stamps alone. And there are plenty more people on these other programs that we've talked about. And even benefits like the child tax credit and these sorts of popular family benefits that aren't just for people in the lowest of income brackets. This is a pretty solid middle class benefit. And so making those cuts, and there's also policy changes in here. They want tighter work rules for beneficiaries. There would be restrictions to programs like Social Security, disability insurance for people who are authorized to work in the U.S. These aren't just cost-saving items. These are trying to stiffen the standards and even in some cases stiffen the penalties for these types of programs.
Well, and it does reflect perhaps Mulvaney, his time when he was in the House, but he also said this is a budget that puts taxpayers first. How do you interpret that?
Right. I think the argument is the White House is facing so much flack for cutting these programs. Even fellow Republicans are saying this would be harmful to their constituents, and they've rejected a lot of these cuts even before the budget was officially proposed. And what we're seeing is the White House's real statement of trying to get these things done, and Mick Mulvaney is trying to come in and defend these cuts, but it's obviously very hard to do when you talk about welfare reform, when people, when reporters are asking, okay, what happens to these people? Mm. It's a very smart move from Mr. Mulvaney to say, this is how we're going to steward people's tax dollars better and change the conversation from what happens to these people on Medicaid who may no longer have this coverage.
What happens? Is there anything in the budget about infrastructure? And that was certainly one of the campaign themes that candidate Trump touted on the campaign trail.
This is an interesting piece in the budget, and it's gotten some criticism from some of his supporters. So he's proposed about $200 billion of direct spending, which in the budget it says will eventually equal $1 trillion over 10 years. The argument being that public infrastructure dollars will spur more private sector dollars. But this is something that the jury is really still out on. And a lot of people on Capitol Hill, who even Democrats, who said they wanted to see the full $1 trillion that he promised on the campaign trail, they're now saying he's going back on his word, and they don't know how, they don't know that they can trust mm-hmm. that the White House is saying they're going to have $1 trillion when the only money they're actually laying out is about $200 billion.
How about the Trump tax plan that was released earlier this year? It was basically a one-page document. Do we have any more information on that?
We really don't. What we saw in that document became the assumptions for what was going to drive the next 10 years of growth. But there's really no details that the Trump administration has laid out in this budget. And it's still not clear when that could even come up. The mm-hmm. Trump administration is... President Trump was tweeting this morning about how he thinks the Senate should change its rules so they could get tax reform done, and all these kind of new threats to Congress to start work on these tax plans. But he has not himself laid out what he wants to see.
Almost out of time here, but so what happens next? I assume the Republicans then begin their work on a budget?
Right. So the Republicans are going to be putting theirs out sometime in mid-June. This is something that's largely written by House Republicans. Senate Republicans will have to agree to whatever the House passes sometime later this year. And what will be really interesting to watch there is how the Republicans handle the entitlement spending. President Trump was very clear to not touch Medicare or Social Security retirement benefits. That's probably not the case in the House Republican budget. We've talked to the chairwoman there, Diane Black, and she says that Medicare will be Medicare reforms will be in the budget. And this could be something that aggravates President Trump. He's been very clear that that's not something he wants to do.
Well, stay tuned. Sarah Ferris, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. She covers budgets and appropriations for Politico Pro. After this very short break, we'll be talking about the American Health Care Act. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The House narrowly passed a health care bill, the American Health Care Act, earlier this month. The CBO took a look at it and said last week that 14 million more people would lose their insurance next year than under the Affordable Care Act. That number would skyrocket to 23 million in a decade, although it would save $119 billion in that time. Paige Winfield Cunningham covers health policy for the Washington Post and writes the Power Post tip sheet, The Health 2002, and joins us from the studios of the Washington Post. And Paige, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be on.
And to join our conversation, you can text or call our comment line. We are talking about the American Health Care Act and the fate of the Affordable Care Act. That phone number, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Paige, did this CBO score give a lethal blow to the Republican health care bill?
Well, you know, we already knew a lot of these numbers previously. The CBO, in sort of initial estimates back in March, had already said that it would cost about 24 million people coverage in a decade. The savings were somewhat greater at that point. But this is the final word from the CBO, and so I think it definitely fuels the attacks by Democrats who are really trying to capitalize on this and argue for keeping the Affordable Care Act because of its coverage expansions.
What's the chance of keeping the Affordable Care Act in this Congress?
I think it would be if Republicans are unable to coalesce around something. I mean, there's some really big questions in the Senate as to what direction that they would go with their own health care bill. And there's many very strong points of disagreement between moderates who really don't want to roll back the Medicaid expansion as quickly or enact some of these reforms to Medicaid that the House bill proposes. On the flip side, this group of conservatives would prefer that the subsidies are less generous and would like to move the bill even more to the right than it already is. And the problem that Majority Leader McConnell faces is he can only lose two votes. Mm. And so it's very unclear at this point whether they'll be able to coalesce around something, although they have said that they're working on legislative language and there may be something that members can look at and consider in terms of an actual bill in the next few weeks.
Let me talk, though, about the House bill, which has certainly passed the House. It was a narrow margin, but basically compare and contrast it to the Affordable Care Act when it comes to things like premiums and benefits and subsidies. What do people need to know?
Right. Well, the bill would phase out Medicaid expansion over a couple of years. The pretty large chunk of Americans, those around 100% of the federal poverty level, slightly above that, slightly below, would have to get their coverage through private plans. Similar to the Affordable Care Act, they could get subsidies, but these subsidies would be less generous and they would be based on a person's age rather than someone's income. They also wouldn't be tied to the subsidies themselves. And so for some people, especially folks in the around 50 to 65 age range, would see their premiums skyrocket and they wouldn't get enough corresponding subsidies to pay for them. And so as a result, their monthly costs could go up dramatically.
How dramatically?
Some by as much as 850%, according to this estimate from the CBO last week. Now, this of course, is the CBO had a lot of estimates and had to make a lot of calculations, which may or may not play out. But I think what can be said with certainty is that premiums would go up for older people because insurers under this GOP plan would be allowed to charge older people five times more what they would charge younger people instead of just three times as laid out under the Affordable Care Act.
And that's that age versus income differential.
Right, exactly. Now, the GOP plan does cap subsidies above a certain income level. It's like 75 grand, I think, maybe for an individual. Mm-hmm. But they would be largely based on age.
What is the CBO track record? Because it seems when they came out with their scoring, there was a lot of criticism saying, well, you know, look at the CBO. They didn't track correctly when it came to the Affordable Care Act.
Well, this whole thing gets very hypocritical because you're exactly right that the CBO had projected that the Affordable Care Act was going to reduce the uninsured rate by much more than it actually has. We still have about 20 million people without coverage, and the CBO had originally projected that would be much lower. Now, part of that is because the Supreme Court said states could opt out of Medicaid expansion. So there's a portion of people that were supposed to get coverage that way that didn't. That's something that the CBO just could not have foreseen. The marketplace enrollment also has not been what was originally projected, has fallen short in a lot of areas. But it's important to remember when the CBO makes its projections, it's a very hard, complicated thing to do, and they have to make a lot of assumptions about how states would behave. And, you know, that's something that's always been true, regardless of which political party is in power. But, you know, you really see Republicans and Democrats kind of shift their tune on the CBO depending on whether the score is something that they like or dislike. So for a long time, Republicans were, you know, shaking the finger at the CBO and Democrats and saying, ha ha, you know, this projection was wrong. And, you know, now they're trying to kind of use that to discredit the numbers that they're coming out with now, even though they aren't giving the real recognizing the leeway that the CBO has.
The Affordable Care Act is still, as I understand it, Paige, is still the law of the land. It has not been upended by the American Health Care Act. Is it collapsing? Because certainly critics say that. And you hear anecdotally about people whose premiums have gone up dramatically and who have, you know, have fewer benefits in the plans that they have under the ACA.
I think it depends on which state you're in. I think there's a very strong argument to be made that in certain states, the marketplaces are headed for a lot of trouble. There are some very large portions of area in states like Missouri, in Iowa, that other states where insurers are withdrawing, where people may only have one plan option mm-hmm. or no plan options next year.
Is that possible? There'd be a state with no plan options?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the administration is going to have to figure out how to respond to that, whether you would just remove the penalty for being uninsured on those people or kind of what the response would be. This is something that the Obama administration had to actually consider last year, because for a while we thought that there was going to be a county in Arizona that wasn't going to have any insurers. The administration ultimately was able to convince one insurer to sell plans there. But the Trump administration doesn't have the same interest in trying to bring insurers into the marketplace. And so at this point, we don't know yet. We're still waiting on rates this summer, but there could very well be places where people don't have choices in the marketplaces next year. So I think if you want to criticize the ACA or praise it, you can kind of pick and choose. But overall, the marketplaces are in some pretty deep trouble.
Because of just systemic problems within the Affordable Care Act, or the fact that we have so many people with pre-existing conditions, and just the cost, the overall cost of healthcare in this country?
Well, I think the mix of enrollees haven't been what insurers had originally projected. And that's potentially for a number of reasons. You can argue that the individual mandate and the fine for being uninsured wasn't large enough to work as an incentive to convince these healthy people to buy plans. And then there's been a subset of people who just haven't found the plans affordable because the subsidies aren't large enough. These are people that are sort of at the top of that income range who might be eligible for a little bit of subsidy, or people above 400% federal poverty level who are buying on the individual market but can't get a subsidy. You know, these folks, say it's, you know, a family earning around, you know, $95,000 a year, you know, they live comfortably, but it's still very difficult to afford a premium that might be $1,000 or more every month. And so there's a subsection of people that really are finding it unaffordable. So I think just for a number of reasons, the insurers have found it really difficult to cover and profit from these enrollees in the marketplaces.
And that's Paige Winfield Cunningham. She covers health policy for the Washington Post. She writes the Power Post tip sheet, the Health 202, getting us up to speed on the American Health Care Act and the debate within Washington, within Congress, about what to do about health care. And again, you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. What do you want your Congress to do? You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Paige, it seems that there are many fights when it comes to this health care bill or proposed bill, but it seems the fight is pretty intense over things like pre-existing conditions. Do you see that as a center of this debate?
Well, it was interesting how it really did emerge as this flashpoint in the House discussions, and it actually wasn't a big point of criticism that Republicans have had over the last few years. So it was really surprising that this kind of emerged. But I think this really speaks to voters, because everyone has a family member, has a friend who have a pre-existing condition, who maybe have struggled with cancer or diabetes or something else. It's important to note or to understand what the Republican bill would do. So it is true that states could get this waiver to basically allow insurers to charge people with pre-existing conditions more. But there are a couple of rules around this. A person with a pre-existing condition would actually have to lack coverage or fall out of insurance for 62 days before the insurer could charge them a higher premium. Right. And even then, the insurer could only charge them a higher premium for a year. And so, yes, there would be some people with pre-existing conditions who would be affected, but certainly not people in every state. And then people only who fit into that category. But it's a real political sticking point because it's very easy then for Democrats to point the finger at Republicans and say, oh, you're going to take insurance away from the people who need it the most. And so I think that's why you saw a lot of moderates in the House really, really concerned. And they were the ones who ultimately insisted on including this extra funding for these high-risk pools to help people with pre-existing conditions so that then they could make the argument that, you know, we're still taking care of this highly vulnerable population.
Well, as you're talking, I'm thinking of those angry town hall meetings of the last month or so where members of Congress got a real earful, and a lot of the angry constituents seem to be concerned about pre-existing conditions.
Well, right. And I think a lot of these folks have real reason to be concerned because when you do think about, you know, the Affordable Care Act, one of the high points and the most popular points about the law was that, you know, for the first time, the insurer couldn't charge higher rates to people with pre-existing conditions. And that's huge for people who might otherwise face massive premiums that they could never afford. And so it's very understandable why there was so much frustration about this. At the same time, I think your average voter doesn't really understand the nuances of the Republican plan, and perhaps the effects of it on people with pre-existing conditions were overstated a little bit.
Well, and we do have the most complicated and the most expensive health care plan, I believe, in the developed world, and it doesn't seem like any of these fixes are going to make it any less complicated.
Well, right. And I think this is something that Republicans are discovering. You know, traditionally, they haven't taken a very active role in healthcare policy. Most of them don't really understand. I mean, most people overall don't understand. You know, there's so many different parties involved. There's the providers, there's the payers, there's the consumers. And so I think in the Senate, especially, a lot of the process has really just been trying to educate Republicans. You know, when they have these huddles over healthcare, it's just understanding how things work so that the members even know how to talk about it. So that's the point that they're starting from. And when you understand that, it's not as surprising why it's taking them so long to come up with something that everyone could agree to.
Well, it's interesting. You had a couple of quotes from Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate. I don't know how we get 50 votes at this point. He also talked about replacing the Affordable Care Act is going to be difficult. Just underscoring what you just said there, Paige, which is this is a large part of our economy and many moving parts.
Well, absolutely. And there's just so many interest groups involved, and you need to get them all at the table if you really want to pass something that, you know, that's what Democrats did with the Affordable Care Act is, you know, the industry, the insurers, the providers, there were some taxes they didn't like. They didn't like every part of the bill back in 2010. But, you know, the administration and Democrats got them at the table and said, hey, if you guys contribute this, we'll give you this. And in the end, they ultimately, you know, agreed to the bill. And you don't see Republicans doing that. Virtually every medical association is against it. The insurers, while they haven't come out, you know, directly against it, they've had a lot of criticisms. And so that's something that Republicans are really up against as they try to forge an agreement.
We have an email from Mike. He says, there's nothing wrong with the Affordable Care Act that couldn't be fixed by a Congress that put country ahead of hyperpartisanship. Do you see it that way, Paige?
You know, this goes to the question of the system set up under the Affordable Care Act, which is sort of this middle ground. It's not government-run healthcare. It's not a public option. Although there was Medicaid expansion, but a big part of it was, of course, the federal government subsidizing these private plans. And that's actually a pretty costly endeavor for the government because basically now it's required to pay out to subsidize these plans over which it has no control how much insurers are ultimately going to charge. So, you know, people that are critics from the left of the ACA would point to it and say, we really should have just gone with a single payer plan. We should have just done what most other developed countries have done in the world and had a similar system to that. And that the conservative critics are going to say, well, you know, now we have all of this government involvement, government regulation, and it's really not a free market. And so, you know, I think there's critics from both the right and the left. And I think there's a pretty strong feeling that certainly the Affordable Care Act did some really important things, but also fell short in some pretty significant ways, too.
Who is Elizabeth McDonough, Senate parliamentarian, and why should we care about her, Paige?
She is incredibly powerful in this effort, this Republican effort to repeal and replace. She is the one who ultimately rules on which parts of the Affordable Care Act can be repealed and replaced. That's just because Republicans are using a special vehicle called budget reconciliation, and they're doing that because they don't want to have to get any Democrats on board. So using budget reconciliation, they can pass it with only a simple majority in the Senate instead of 60 votes. And Republicans hold 52 seats in the Senate, meaning that they could lose two of their own members, have Vice President Pence cast a tie-breaking vote, and boom, there you have a bill repealing the Affordable Care Act. There are very strict rules around what can be put in budget reconciliation. It has to affect federal spending, and the person who ultimately decides whether these elements have a close enough of effect on federal spending is Elizabeth McDonough, the parliamentarian. And so that's why I took a look at her, who she is, what people think about her in this piece that we published this morning. She didn't give me an interview because she really tries to stay behind the scenes. Right. It's a nonpartisan role, and so she really, you know, she doesn't want to be perceived as being on one side or the other. But, you know, this is somebody who, you know, it's like everybody's talking about the parliamentarian. Nobody really knows her. So she's a very interesting character right now.
Absolutely. Well, Paige, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Paige Winfield Cunningham. She covers health policy for The Washington Post. We have a third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about President Trump's trip to Europe. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Trump returned from his 9-day trip this past weekend, tweeting, "Trip was a great success for America. Hard work, but big results." German Chancellor Angela Merkel expressed disappointment following the NATO and G7 meetings with Trump, saying the times in which we rely on others, they are somewhat over. Unlike previous presidents, Trump did not overtly reinforce the agreement of mutual defense between the U.S. and its NATO partners, known as Article 5. He said he would decide about whether to honor the Paris Accord on climate change after his trip was over. Well, we asked Judy Dempsey to join us. She's senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, editor-in-chief of the Strategic Europe blog. And Judy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back.
Does the German chancellor speak for her fellow NATO members when she spoke about Trump and the United States?
Oh, I think so. I also think she spoke for some Europeans as well. I mean, Merkel has this quality of being very cautious, and she only speaks bluntly when she really thinks there's a case to be made. And I think coming back from the NATO summit and coming back from the G7 summit in Sicily, she felt that she had to call a spade, and this is what she did.
What did she want? What did she want from President Trump?
I think she wanted a couple of things. I think she wanted reassurance that the transatlantic relationship would continue. She wanted some degree of predictability, which at the moment under the Trump administration is more than 100 days. It's not very predictable. And she wanted really reassurances over climate change, and that Trump won't actually pull down the barriers or rather put them up when it comes to protectionism. And she got very little from this. She just wanted a feeling that the West was getting together, and she didn't come away from Brussels or Sicily with that feeling.
Let me play just a small clip, and this is President Trump speaking at the meeting with European Union leaders in Brussels. This was on Thursday, and I should say he mentions Stoltenberg. He's the NATO Secretary General. Let's give it a listen.
The NATO of the future must include a great focus on terrorism and immigration, as well as threats from Russia and on NATO's eastern and southern borders. These grave security concerns are the same reason that I have been very, very direct with Secretary Stoltenberg and members of the alliance in saying that NATO members must finally contribute their fair share and meet their financial obligations.
Judy, have they been dragging their feet about paying their bills?
I think that's a very good clip from President Trump. It's realistic and it's fair. Yes, they have been dragging their feet. They've been dragging their feet for decades because the Europeans just took the dependence on the United States for granted. They took for granted also the security guarantees, and they took for granted that they could just get away with spending here and there. Those days are over. They were over before President Trump entered the White House. But now, I mean, he's laid it heavily down on the line. The Europeans are just so discombobulated when it comes to defense spending. Hmm. They, you know, very different weapon systems, very different tank systems. They just don't have a unified weapons, tanks, air force system. Trump was right on this. It's time to end the sort of self-denial, and now the Europeans have to step up to the plate.
Will they do it?
Some are. It's a very complicated question you ask. Will they do it? Yes.
I hear hesitation in your voice. No, go ahead, Judy.
Yes, they will do it. But government leaders have to explain to their electorates why they should spend more on defense. Okay, we've got the Russia threat, we've got the huge migration issue, we've got huge instability on our southern borders. Isn't that enough to spend more on secure borders, on security? But one more thing, they should spend on the security of their citizens, for the infrastructure, for resilience, for airports, for nuclear in infrastructure, for so many things. And some countries are spending, but it's spending is not the issue. It's how it's what is spent. Hmm. And I think the Europeans could be much. They wouldn't have to spend 2% of gross domestic product, as Trump keeps going on about. They could just spend more wisely and spend together instead of duplicating their assets.
Trump, President Trump did talk about never forsaking our allies, talking about our NATO allies, but he did not overtly use the words related to Article 5, which is all about mutual defense.
Yes.
What do you think the message, or how was that message received in Europe?
Very badly, and the allies are very worried. It's rare that a U.S. president doesn't talk about collective defense, which is enshrined in Article 5 of the founding treaty of NATO, the Washington Treaty, which says an attack on one NATO country is an attack on all, and they should support it. And it's what the Europeans did when after September 9/11. It's worrying because Trump sees it as a kind of business arrangement. You pay up, then I support you. If you don't pay up, well, you know, shucks, I mean, that's your problem. But it's much more complex than this because this is about a Western alliance of values, of interests, of shared security risks. And if President Trump wants the Europeans to help him in dealing with Islamic terrorism, well, frankly, he could be a little bit more, how would you call it, softer in terms of the allies, but the alliance is in very bad shape, in a nutshell, frankly.
I saw someone make a commentary, write a commentary that President Trump, when he went to Saudi Arabia, said, "I'm not here to lecture our allies in the Middle East," but it appears as he was very comfortable lecturing Europe.
Yes, I think this is very, very important. I mean, Trump has Trump didn't lecture the Saudis. He doesn't lecture the Philippines that much. He has a sort of a penchant for quasi or authoritarian regimes. The thing about he lecturing the Europeans is that the Europeans didn't take it lying down, and I think it's really good that they came to Brussels because the allies spoke openly. These are democratic countries. And then when he went down to Sicily for the G7, you had Japan, you had Britain, you had France, you had Italy, you had Germany, you had Canada. These are seriously democratic countries. And I think it was really good that they gave him some lectures as well. So frankly, it wasn't a one-way street.
And that's Judy Dempsey, senior fellow at Carnegie Europe, also editor-in-chief of the Strategic Europe blog. And we are talking about President Trump's visit to Europe. And you can join our conversation. Call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think of the president's trip to Europe? And what do you think was accomplished? Well, interestingly, Judy, you talk about European leaders not taking it lying down. There was much made of the handshake between President Trump and Macron, the new president of France, sort of not willing to be sort of jerked around by the American president and sort of holding firm to the hand. Also, another photo op where President Trump appears to kind of brush aside the prime minister of Montenegro. I don't want to make too much of this, but what do you make of these? Okay, go ahead. These photo ops. What does that tell you?
Let's take Macron.
Okay.
I think Emmanuel Macron, the new president of France, he was completely right to be firm with Trump, with the handshake and other things. And he said to Trump, you know, in private conversation, you know, I'm the new president. This is somebody who's back. And Trump allegedly said to him, oh, no, I was always backing you. Uh-huh. I mean, frankly, Macron stood up for what he believed in and stood his ground with President Trump, both in Brussels and Sicily. And I think this is quite important. Interestingly, Macron had President Putin in the Versailles Palace yesterday, Monday, and it wasn't interesting that Russia supported the far-right-wing candidate Marine Le Pen, head of the National Front, to be the next president of France, and so did Trump. I mean, what a collusion of interest. In any case, we have Macron in the Elysee Palace now. But actually, this is it was very important that Macron made this point. And on your other question was
about pushing aside the or appearing to push aside the Prime Minister of Montenegro.
I mean, we don't know what happened way back at the queue, frankly. But yes, I saw this. Actually, I thought it was quite rude, and it was. I'm sorry, but the Americans have such a good reputation for graciousness and good manners and making people feel comfortable. And I got the impression when I was covering the NATO summit, I got the impression that there was no small talk pushing his way to the front. It didn't really go down well, but this is what we're in for. And that's why the G7 leaders, the G6 plus the US, gave as good as they got in Sicily about the big issues that affect the West.
Speaking of France and its new president, Macron, do you see France playing a more dominant role in Europe?
Yes, I do. Just one little caveat. Macron has parliamentary elections in the next couple of weeks.
That's
so
true.
He has to secure, in the National Assembly, he has to secure quite a lot of support there to push through his reforms. That said, he's young, he's not flashy, and he knows Chancellor Angela Merkel very, very well. He's made many, many visits to Berlin, and he's got a team that speaks German as well. So France will make a difference to Europe because the Franco-German alliance will get much stronger. And without Paris and Berlin working much more closely together, Europe will not go anywhere. I'm actually one of the few optimists that believe that Europe will pull through this crisis. It's not over. The migration crisis isn't over. The euro currency crisis isn't over. And the populism won't disappear. But it's slowly getting there. And Macron exudes a confidence. And he's got a steely, steady team around him.
Does Europe need the United States?
Yes. Europe needs the United States. And it's just not only through NATO. Europe desperately needs the United States because despite all the headlines about how Trump deals with the FBI and intelligence and everything else, Europe would be a far less safer place without intelligence sharing, particularly between Paris and Washington.
Oops, we seem to have lost our guest. Let's see if we can call her back. That's Judy Dempsey, Senior Fellow at Carnegie Europe, Editor-in-Chief of the Strategic Europe blog. And she's been giving us her thoughts, her opinion about President Trump's trip to Europe. He, of course, began in the Middle East and spent a couple of days in Italy, in Belgium, and talking with European leaders there. We've been getting her take on a number of things, including President Trump's speech. She said she believes that he was totally correct and it was appropriate for him to tell NATO members to pay their bills. She also talked about the now, I guess, famous or infamous handshake with the president of France, Macron. You can join our conversation. You can call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Much has been made about President Trump's trip to Europe. We'd love to hear your comments as well. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And this is a three-part show. From time to time, we do like to catch up on some of the news, whether here in the United States or abroad. And this hour gave us a chance to do that, beginning talking about the budget debate coming out of the Trump White House and how that has been playing out in the U.S. Congress, and of course, plans to reform the Affordable Care Act, or to change the Affordable Care Act, or to upend it as well. And again, you can join us, text us, call our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we hope to reconnect with Judy Dempsey. We had her on the line. She's been joining us from Europe, where she lives. An email from Edward. He says, companies that offer insurance coverage are in the business of evaluating risk and pricing for that risk. There is a problem when many who are the highest risk with health problems are low income or survive only by societal programs. And that's always an issue when it comes to insurance, which is how you spread the risk, whether you're driving a car or whether you're getting health insurance. Another comment, one of the moral issues is that is to what extent individuals will be held accountable for their own behavior. Should healthcare costs of people who smoke, who abuse alcohol or drugs, who are obese or engage in high-risk sports, these are unresolved issues. And of course, again, that's something that gets debated when it comes to insurance. And of course, some of the pre-existing conditions are because of people's behavior, and some of it is because of just the sadness of sometimes finding yourself in a difficult health situation. I'm talking and reading at the same time. Never a good thing. We have a tweet from Peter. Europe to Trump, you want us to be full and equal partners? You got it. Also a voicemail from David. He says, are there any studies of catastrophic health insurance that are trusted and identify the concrete benefits of it by demographics? I do not have the answer to that, but hopefully we can pick up on some of the calls, the questions that you had in a future edition of Radio Times. Well, it looks like we're not going to get Judy Dempsey. Again, Senior Fellow at Carnegie Europe, Editor-in-Chief of Strategic Europe blog. And she is someone that we do call up from time to time to get her opinion about how things are in Europe. And she covers NATO, the EU, and we were going to talk about the Paris Climate Accord as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.